The aroma of roasting beef and potatoes was like running into a brick wall. The saliva spurted from under his tongue, and he started forward again, suddenly ravenous. In the tiny makeshift kitchen, a gaunt figure stood over the wood fire. His hair was soft and white as cotton wool, and he looked up accusingly as Craig stood in the doorway. "Why did you not send for me?" he demanded in Cinderbelly. "Nobody else cooks on Kingilingi." "Joseph!" Craig cried, and embraced him impetuously. The old man had been Bawoo's cook for 30 years. He could lay a formal banquet for 50 guests, or whip up a hunter's pot on a bush fire. Already there was bread baking in the tin trunk he had improvised as an oven, and he had gleaned a bowl of salad from the neglected garden. Joseph extricated himself from Craig's embrace, a little ruffled by this breach of etiquette. "Ngozana," Joseph still used the diminutive address, "your clothes were filthy and your bed was unmade," he lectured Craig sternly. "We have worked all day to tidy the mess you have made." Only then did Craig notice the other man in the kitchen. "Kapalala," he laughed delightedly, and the houseboy grinned and bobbed with pleasure. He was at work with a heavy black smoothing iron, filled with glowing coals. All Craig's clothes and bed linen had been washed and were being ironed to crisp perfection. The walls of the cottage had been washed down and the floor polished to a gloss. Even the brass taps on the sink shone like the buttons on a marine's dress uniform. "I have made a list of things we need," Joseph told Craig. "They will do for the time being, but it is unfitting that you should live like this in a hovel. Nkosi Bawe, your grandfather, would have disapproved." Joseph, the cook, had a definite sense of style. "Thus I have sent a message to my senior wife's uncle, who is a master thatcher, and told him to bring his eldest son, who is a bricklayer, and his nephew, who is a fine carpenter. They will be here tomorrow to begin repairing the damage that these dogs have done to the big house. As for the gardens, I know a man," and he ticked off on his fingers what he considered necessary to restore King's Lynn to some sort of order. "Thus we will be ready to invite 30 important guests to Christmas dinner like we used to in the old days. Now, Nkosana, go and wash. Dinner will be ready in 15 minutes. With the home paddocks securely fenced, and the work on the restoration of the outbuildings and main homestead well in hand, Craig could at last begin the vital step of restocking. He summoned Shadrach and Joseph, and gave King's Lynn into their joint care during his absence. They accepted the responsibility gravely. Then Craig drove to the airport, left the Land Rover in the car park, and boarded the commercial flight southwards. For the next 3 weeks he toured the great cattle stud ranches of northern Transvaal, the province of South Africa whose climate and conditions most closely resembled those of Matabeleland. The purchases of blood cattle were not transactions that could be hurried. Each was preceded by days of discussion with the seller and study of the beasts themselves, while Craig enjoyed the traditional hospitality of the Afrikaner country folk. His hosts were men whose ancestors had trekked northwards from the Cape of Good Hope, drawn by their oxen, and had lived all their lives close to their animals. So, while Craig purchased their stock, he drew upon their accumulated wisdom and experience, and came from each transaction with his own knowledge and understanding of cattle immensely enriched. All he learned reinforced his desire to follow Bawoo's successful experiments with crossbreeding the indigenous Afrikaner strain, known for its hardiness and disease and drought resistance, with the quicker-yielding Santa Gertrudis strain. He bought young cows that had been artificially inseminated and were well in calf. He bought bulls of fine pedigree from famous bloodlines and laboured through the documentation and inspection and inoculation and quarantine and insurance that were necessary before they could be permitted to cross an international border. In the meantime, he arranged for road transportation northwards to King's Lynn by contractors who specialised in carrying precious livestock. He spent almost $2 million of his borrowed dollars before flying back to King's Lynn to make the final preparations for the arrival of his cattle. The deliveries of the bloodstock were to be staggered over a period of months so that each consignment could be properly received and allowed to settle down before the arrival of the next batch. The first to arrive were four young bulls, just ready to take up their stud duties. Craig had paid $15,000 for each of them. Peter Fungabera was determined to make an important occasion out of their arrival. He persuaded two of his brother ministers to attend the welcoming ceremony, though neither the Prime Minister nor the Minister of Tourism, Comrade Tungata Zabiwa, was available on that day. Craig hired a marquee tent, while Joseph happily and importantly prepared one of his legendary alfresco banquets. Craig was still smarting from having paid out $2 million, so he went cheap on the champagne, ordering the imitation from the Cape of Good Hope rather than the genuine article. The ministerial party arrived in a fleet of black Mercedes, accompanied by their heavily armed bodyguards, all sporting aviator-type sunglasses. Their ladies were dressed in full-length safari prints, of the wildest and most improbable colours. The cheap, sweet champagne went down as though a plug had been pulled out of a bath, and they were all soon twittering and giggling like a flock of glossy starlings. The Minister of Education's senior wife unbuttoned her blouse, produced a succulent black bosom, and gave the infant on her hip an early lunch while herself taking on copious quantities of champagne. "Refueling in flight," one of Craig's white neighbours, who had been an RAF bomber pilot, remarked with a grin. Peter Fungabera was the last to arrive, wearing full dress, and driven by a young aide, a captain in the 3rd Brigade, whom Craig had noticed on several other occasions. This time Peter introduced him. "Captain Timon Inbebe." He was so thin as to appear almost frail. His eyes behind the steel-rimmed spectacles were too vulnerable for a soldier, and his grip was quick and nervous. Craig would have liked to have spoken to him, but by this time the transporter carrying the bulls was already grinding up the hills. It arrived in a cloud of fine red dust before the enclosure of split poles that Craig had built to receive the bulls. The gangplank was lowered, but before the tailgate was raised, Peter Fungabera climbed up onto the dais and addressed the assembly. "Mr. Craig Mello is a man who could have chosen any country in the world to live, and as an internationally best-selling writer, would have been welcomed there. He chose to return to Zimbabwe, and in doing so has declared to all of the world that here is a land where men of any colour, of any tribe, black or white, Mashona or Matabele, are free to live and work, unafraid and unmolested, safe in the rule of just laws." After the political commercial, Peter Fungabera allowed himself a little joke. "We will now welcome to our midst these other new immigrants, in the sure knowledge that they will be the fathers of many fine sons and daughters, and contribute to the prosperity of our own great Zimbabwe." Peter Fungabera led the applause as Craig raised the gate and the first new immigrant emerged to stand blinking in the sunlight. He was an enormous beast, over a ton of bulging muscles under the glistening red-brown hide. He had just endured 16 hours penned up in a noisy, lurching machine. The tranquilizers he had been given had worn off, leaving him with a drug hangover and a bitter grudge against the entire world. Now he looked down on the clapping throng, on the swirling colours of the women's national costumes, and he found at last a focus for his irritation and frustration. He let out a long, ferocious bellow, and dragging his handlers behind him, he launched himself like an avalanche down the gangplank. The handlers released their hold on the restrainers, and the split pole barrier exploded before his charge, as did the ministerial party. They scattered like sardines at the rush of hungry barracuda. High officials overtook their wives in a race for the sanctuary of the jacaranda trees. Infants strapped onto the women's backs howled as loudly as their dams. The bull went into one side of the luncheon marquee, still at a dead run, gathering up the guy ropes on its massive shoulders, so the tent came down in graceful billows of canvas, trapping beneath it a horde of panic-stricken revellers. He was emerged from the further side of the collapsing marquee just as one of the younger ministerial wives sprinted shrilling with terror across his path. He hooked at her with one long forward-raked horn and the point caught in the fluttering hem of her dress. The bull jerked his head up, and the brightly coloured material unwrapped from the girl's body like the string from a child's top. She spun in an involuntary pirouette, caught her balance, and then, stark naked, went bounding up the hill with long legs flashing and abundant breasts bouncing elastically. 2-1, the filly to win by a tit, howled the RAF bomber pilot ecstatically. He had also fueled up on the cheap champagne. The gaudy dress had wrapped itself around the bull's head. It served to goad him beyond mere anger into the deadly passion of the corrida bull facing the matador's cape. He swung his great armed head from one side to the other, the dress swirling rakishly like a battle ensign in a high wind, and exposing one of his wicked little eyes, which lighted on the Honourable Minister of Education, the least fleet-footed of the runners, who was making heavy weather of the slope. The minister was carrying the burden of flesh that behoves a man of such importance. His belly wobbled mountainously beneath his waistcoat. His face was grey as last night's ashes, and he screamed in a girlish falsetto of terror and exhaustion, "Shoot it! Shoot the devil!" His bodyguards ignored the instruction. They were leading him by 50 paces and rapidly widening the gap. Craig watched helplessly from his grandstand position on the transporter as the bull lowered his head and drove up the slope after the fleeing minister. Dust spurted from under his hooves, and he bellowed again. The blast of sound, only inches from the ministerial backside, seemed physically to lift and propel the Honourable Minister the last few paces, and he turned out to be a much better climber than sprinter. He went up the trunk of the first jacaranda like a squirrel and hung precariously in the lower branches, with the bull directly beneath him. The bull bellowed again in murderous frustration, glaring up at the cowering figure, tore at the earth with his front hooves, and gored the air with full-blooded swings of his vicious white-tipped horns. "Do something!" shrieked the minister. "Make it go away!" His bodyguard looked back over their shoulders, and seeing the impasse, regained their courage. They halted, unslung their weapons, and began cautiously closing in on the bull and his victim. "No!" Craig yelled over the rattle of loading automatic weapons. "Don't shoot!" He was certain that his insurance did not cover death by deliberate rifle fire, and quite apart from the $15,000, a volley would sweep the area behind the bull, which included the marquee and its occupants, a scattering of fleeing women and children, and Craig himself. One of the uniformed bodyguards raised his rifle and took aim. His recent exertions and terror did nothing for the steadiness of his hand. The muzzle of his weapon described widening circles in the air. "No!" Craig bellowed again, and flung himself face down on the floor of the trailer. At that moment, a tall, skinny figure stepped between the wavering rifle muzzle and the great bull. "Shadrach," whispered Craig thankfully, as the old man imperiously pushed up the rifle barrel and then turned to face the bull. "I see you, Inkunzi Kakulu, great bull," he greeted him courteously. The bull swung its head to the sound of his voice, and very clearly he saw Shadrach also. He snorted and nodded threateningly. "How, prince of cattle, how beautiful you are!" Shadrach advanced a pace towards those vicious, pike-sharp horns. The bull pawed at the earth, and then made a warning rush at him. Shadrach stood him down, and the bull stopped. "How noble your head!" he crooned. "Your eyes are like dark moons." The bull hooked his horns towards him, but the swing was less vicious, and Shadrach answered with another step forward. The shrieks of terror-struck women and children died away. Even the most faint-hearted stopped running and looked back at the old man and the red beast. "Your horns are sharp as the stabbing assegai of great Mzilikatsi." Shadrach kept moving forward, and the bull blinked uncertainly and squinted at him with red-rimmed eyes. "How glorious are your testicles," Shadrach murmured soothingly, "like huge boulders of granite. 10,000 cows will feel their weight and majesty." The bull backed up a pace, and gave another half-hearted toss of his head.
"Your breath is hot as the north wind, my peerless king of bulls."
Shadrach stretched out his hand slowly, and they watched in breathless silence.
"My darling,"
Shadrach touched the glossy, wet, chocolate-coloured muzzle, and the bull jerked away nervously, and then came back cautiously to snuffle at Shadrach's fingers.
"My sweet darling, father of great bulls." Gently, Shadrach slipped his forefinger into the heavy bronze nose ring and held the bull's head.
He stooped and placed his mouth over the gaping, pink-lined nostrils and blew his own breath loudly into them. The bull shuddered, and Craig could clearly see the bunched muscles in his shoulders relaxing. Shadrach straightened, and with his finger still through the nose ring, walked away. And placidly, the bull waddled after him, with his dewlap swinging. A weak little cheer of relief and disbelief went up from his audience, and subsided as Shadrach cast a withering, contemptuous eye around him.
"Ngosi," he called to Craig, "get these chattering Mashona monkeys off our land. They are upsetting my darling," he ordered.
And Craig hoped fervently that none of his highly placed guests understood Cinderbelly. Craig marvelled once again at the almost mystical bond that existed between the Nguni peoples and their cattle. From that age long obscured by the mists of time, when the first herds had been driven out of Egypt to begin the centuries-long migrations southwards, the destinies of black man and beast had been inexorably linked. This humpbacked strain of cattle had originated in India, their genus Bos Indicus, distinct from the European Bos Taurus, but over the ages had become as African as the tribes that cherished and shared their lives with them. It was strange, Craig pondered, that the cattle-herding tribes seemed always to have been the most dominant and warlike. People such as the Maasai and Bechuana and Zulu had always lorded it over the mere tillers of the earth. Perhaps it was their constant need to search for grazing, to defend it against others, and to protect their herds from predators, both human and animal, that made them so bellicose. Watching Shadrach lead the huge bull away, there was no mistaking that lordly arrogance now. Master and beast were noble in their alliance. Not so the Minister of Education, still clinging cat-like to his perch in the jacaranda. Craig went to add his entreaties to those of his bodyguards, who were encouraging him to descend to earth once more. Peter Fungabera was the last of the official party to leave. He accompanied Craig on a tour of the homestead, sniffing appreciatively the sweet odour of the golden thatching grass that already covered half the roof area. "My grandfather replaced the original thatch with corrugated asbestos during the war," Craig explained. "Your RPG-7 rocket shells were hot little darlings."
"Yes," Peter agreed evenly. "We started many a good bonfire with them."
"To tell the truth, I am grateful for the chance to restore the building. Thatch is cooler and more picturesque, and both the wiring and plumbing needed replacing."
"I must congratulate you on what you have accomplished in such a short time. You will soon be living in the grand manner that your ancestors have always enjoyed since they first seized this land."
Craig looked at him sharply, searching for malice, but Peter's smile was as charming and easy as always. "All these improvements add vastly to the value of the property," Craig pointed out, "and you own a goodly share of them."
"Of course," Peter laid a hand placatingly on Craig's forearm. "And you still have much work ahead of you. The development of Zambezi Waters, when will you begin on that?"
"I'm almost ready to do so. As soon as the rest of the stock arrives, and I have Sally Ann to assist with the details."
"Ah," said Peter. "Then you can begin immediately. Sally Ann Jay flew into Harare Airport yesterday morning."
Craig felt a tingle of rising pleasure and anticipation.
"I'll go into town this evening to phone her."
Peter Fungabera clucked with annoyance.
"Have they not installed your telephone yet? I'll see you have it tomorrow. In the meantime, you can patch through on my radio."
The telephone linesman arrived before noon the following day. and Sally Ann Cessna buzzed in from the east an hour later. Craig had a smudge pot of old engine oil and rags burning to mark the disused airstrip and give her the wind direction, and she touched down and taxied to where he had parked the Land Rover. When she jumped down from the cabin, Craig found he had forgotten the alert, quick way she moved and the shape of her legs in tight-fitting blue denim. Her smile was of genuine pleasure and her handshake firm and warm. She was wearing nothing beneath the cotton shirt. She noticed his eyes flicker down and then guiltily up again, but she showed no resentment. "What a lovely ranch, from the air," she said. "Let me show you," he offered, and she dropped her bag on the back seat of the Land Rover and swung her leg over the door like a boy.